Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gematis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John.
Hello, Dave.
Now, we're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, John, what's happening in spaceflight and astronomy?
Okay, well, first of all, Dave, I'll ask you a question. In this momentous week that we've just had with the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, are you all mooned out? There's been so much stuff on television.
There has been a lot, hasn't there? Mm. But at, the bit I enjoy most, actually, is seeing James Burke again. He was such a total professional.
Yeah.
And really, really knew what he was talking about and how to explain it. He was just brilliant. It's just nice seeing him again. I haven't seen him since I was a kid.
That's one that I've got queued up waiting to watch because there's just so much on that I have to record an awful lot of it. But I will catch up with it. What has been interesting to me is seeing how what they've released in terms of reprocessed footage and reproduction of footage that we would have seen had they had appropriate cameras on the Apollo 11 craft as Eagle came in to land at the Sea of Tranquility. The cameras didn't actually record what was, in movie sense, what was being seen by Armstrong and Aldrin as they came into land. But NASA have recreated this using footage from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. Other things that have been done, they've used footage of the walk down the ladder. One or two frames actually showed Neil Armstrong's face. And those frames have been captured and reprocessed to actually show us Neil Armstrong and his face on the moon. Because all of the other pictures, he and Aldrin would have had their gold visor down. But as he walked down in the shadow of the lunar excursion module, there was no need for that gold visor. So the photograph could pick up his face. And that's not been seen before. So it's all been saved up for the 50th anniversary, and there's been some great programs covering the voice tracks and so on of what was said in the capsule that just hadn't been released before now. So I was delighted,
like,
to
get off me foot.
I was delighted to see how even though it's 50 years ago, how it's caught everybody's imagination today, all of the commemorations. Yeah, now and space is clearly quite up there in people's minds. So I'm sure you'll remember me telling you in a previous program about how Israel was attempting to become the fourth nation to land on the moon. That was back in April, and sadly their Bereshit lander failed. But now we've got another attempt underway at the moment to be the fourth nation to soft land on the moon, and that's India. They were due to launch the week before the Apollo celebrations, but bad weather got in the way. So a couple of days after the anniversary, on the 22nd of July, the Indian Space Agency successfully launched a very ambitious mission called Chandrayaan 2 to the moon. It was using their own built launcher, the GSLV Mark III, but it's a three-part mission. There's going to be the Chandrayaan itself, which is going to be an orbiter around the moon, and then a part of that will separate, and that will become Vikram, the lander. That will go down and will be the first spacecraft, if all goes well, to land on the south pole of the moon. Then part of the Vikram will itself separate, and that's a rover called Pragyan, which apparently is Sanskrit for wisdom. And that will deploy down a ramp from the Vikram lander and explore, looking for water ice on the moon. And that is the reason for going to the South Pole. That's the likely area that the Americans will try to land on in 2024, because it's known that there is ice in deep craters. Craters so deep and so well sheltered, because they're exactly on the pole, that the sun never rises above the crater rim. And so the ice that's been there for billions of years is still there. And that ice will be so useful when mankind eventually sets up permanent lunar bases.
Yeah, you need ice with your cocktails, don't you?
Yes, indeed. and to help cook with things of that sort. And I suppose they'll need the occasional bath and shower, whatever. So it's the fourth country. So just to remind you, the three countries that have soft landed were, of course, the Soviet Union, followed by the United States, and more recently, of course, China. So this craft called Chandrayaan is still in Earth orbit, and it's going to follow the same approach that the Israelis did, in the sense of having a series of long looping trajectories, orbits, to get to the moon. So it won't get there until September, and then, as I say, land at the lunar South Pole. The rover and lander are only scheduled to last for 14 days. In other words, 14 Earth days, which is half a lunar day. In other words, the time of the lunar day that the sun is up in the sky, because they're solar powered. So as soon as night comes, they will stop getting power, they'll freeze up, and that'll be them done. But the Chandrayaan orbiter will continue its science missions in orbit, and the design life is to be about a year. Now, in passing, I mentioned the Israeli moon lander, Bereshit. That was very innovative in that it was commercial, built and launched by a not-for-profit organisation. Well, they didn't launch it themselves. It piggybacked on the SpaceX Falcon 9. But it was innovative in the way that it was the first to use this very fuel-economic route, not going directly as hitherto, but using multiple firings of the thruster to gradually increase the elliptical orbit until it was far out enough to be captured by the moon's gravity. And that thruster, by the way, is of course built by a British company based in Oxfordshire.
Of course. We make the best rocket engines.
We do.
We make the ion engines.
Yeah. But as we know, sadly, a software glitch caused it to fail and crash into the surface. However, back in the news again, because this month, they've signed a deal with the a US company called Firefly Aerospace, who are going to build a US version of Bereshit. Essentially, much the same, just a little change in some of the avionics, telemetry, etc. So hopefully to incorporate the British engine, although I don't know that for sure. But Firefly Aerospace are one of several companies that NASA have signed up from the commercial world to launch and land science and other packages on the moon in preparation for the planned US manned landing in 2024. So this Bereshit will live on. So great credit to the Israelis who designed and built it. It'll carry on as part of the NASA manned lunar landing program. Just speaking of that programme, there's been quite a bit of a shake-up at NASA. The previous head of manned spaceflight has been sacked and somebody else put in place just to make sure that they've got somebody a little bit younger and vigorous and motivated to land, to see this landing programme through. And also, the NASA chief has appeared before a congressional committee, you know, pleading for the release of funds. It's all very well for Mike Pence to be pushing the idea of landing on the moon in 5 years' time rather than in 2028 as previously planned. It's all very well to make those announcements, but they've got to back it up with the appropriate funding, and NASA are a little concerned, as are we all. We'll carry on with moon related topics given the recent Apollo celebrations. So as part of that lunar landing, we were talking in an earlier edition of this program, Dave, about Gateway, which is the International Space Station mini version that they're going to put in orbit around the moon, which will act as a way stop for astronauts arriving from the Earth, preparing to go down onto the lunar surface. That's the plan. NASA had planned quite a large habitation module for this space station called Gateway, but because of the advance from 2028 to 2024, they've had to revise their plans, and they've come up with the idea of a much smaller interim habitation module. With the capacity for growth, extra modules to be built on, as indeed happened at the International Space Station. So to try and get this through quickly, rather than develop something from scratch, then let's look to see, you know, well, what vehicles have we got that could maybe be converted into a habitation module? And so Northrop Grumman have been chosen by NASA. Now, Northrop Grumman are the people that launch the Cygnus resupply vessel to the ISS. As you know, SpaceX launched their Dragon resupply vessel. That's one that has the capability of landing again, so science experiments and results and so on are sent back to Earth in the Cygnus reusable vessel, but the Dragon reusable vessel, but the Cygnus one, which is a little bit bigger, isn't designed in that way. That's designed to take as much stuff up to the space station as possible, but then to be burnt up on re-entry. So it's that Cygnus vessel. By the way, although Cygnus, the name, will be familiar to people, usually we associate it with the name Orbital ATK. That was the commercial company that puts Cygnus up there. But that's actually part of Northrop Grumman, who have now incorporated it back into the main company. Now, NASA, who normally put things out to a wide set of people, are fast-tracking a sole contract with Northrop to develop and launch a module, a habitation module, which is completely derived from the Cygnus. And they're the only commercial company that said that they could do this by the end of 2023 in preparation for the landing in 24. So they've are getting the deal, but it's a bit of a departure for NASA to work this way, just having a single contract with somebody without letting it to other contenders. So that will be, once it's in lunar orbit, that will be attached to the power and propulsion element. Actually, probably they will attach it in Earth orbit and send the two out to the moon. But the power and propulsion element has already module has already been signed up by NASA. That's by a company based in the United States, but a bit more international. It's got a part of it in the UK, part in Singapore, somewhere in United Arab Emirates, I think. A company called Maxar Technologies Incorporated. So we're getting things into place for the next moon landing. Moving on, Orion. That's coincidentally another name of a constellation, as is Cygnus, of course. But this Orion that I'm talking about is the NASA Orion. It's the capsule that NASA are building for deep space missions. As we know, we're going to have the Boeing Starliner and the SpaceX Crew Dragon for getting men into low Earth orbit and into up to the International Space Station, but Orion is built for longer journeys to the moon and eventually to Mars. So it's under development, and one of the essential benchmark tests was to demonstrate the launch abort system of the Orion capsule. And same with as with Apollo, you have a rocket mounted on a gantry on top of the actual capsule, and if there is a problem with a malfunctioning launcher, then that blasts the spacecraft and the crew clear of danger. And so we have to test that this works before you put men into such a craft. And the point that you test it is where the vehicle will encounter maximum dynamic pressure. That is when it's starting to get to go really fast through still the relatively dense Earth's atmosphere. So this has just been successfully tested for Orion. Rather than use, of course, the huge space launch system, which will be required to launch the fully laden Orion, they just used a booster stage from a Peacemaker, and actually a Cold War nuclear missile. But they've got stacks of those left over after the disarmament. And so the Peacemaker booster was perfect, with modification, to launch Orion for this test. So that flew up to 31,000 feet, about airliner height. And that only took 50 seconds after launch to get there, and then they fired the separation system, which worked fine. The abort system, the gantry, is then detached from the capsule, which would then be reoriented so that its heat shield is facing the ground, because it's still got to come down, and that's when they would normally deploy parachutes. They didn't bother on this particular occasion with a parachute, because that's already been tested and it's known to work, and it would have cost another couple of million to have attached the parachutes for this test. So they're separate tests, both have now worked. So that's an important step on the road to getting again back to the moon. The first manned flight of Orion is expected in 2022. Something else also Orion related for this last week was the first of the lunar-bound Orions, fully equipped with all of its internal electronics, life support equipment, parachutes, etc. That is built and ready, but it's been mated now for the very first time to the service module, which is in fact a European product built by European Space Agency countries. So that has now been mated and is now to undergo full tests. Now, I've mentioned this Orion capsule and the launch test. I suppose I ought to mention an aside, Dave, at this point. SpaceX, you'll remember that the Crew Dragon exploded as a ground test. SpaceX have identified, together with NASA, that there was a leaking valve that allowed some of the fuel into where it wasn't supposed to be, and when they fired the rockets during a test, that's what caused this colossal explosion, which completely destroyed the Crew Dragon that had actually been up to the International Space Station unmanned. So they're now admitting that it's looking, well, I think their words were, it is becoming increasingly difficult to launch a manned version of the SpaceX Crew Dragon by the end of this year, which is a shame. And similarly, also the Boeing Starliner has also suffered a bit of a setback. They had a fuel leak on whilst getting ready for one of these abort tests. So that has been delayed a little bit. So fingers crossed that they can recover the timescales, but it's contingency needs to be built in when they set these really ambitious dates. Let's leave the moon now, Dave, and go out to our asteroid belt, or in fact to an asteroid that comes fairly close to Earth, and that's the asteroid Ryugu, where of course we've got the Japanese probe Hayabusa 2. Now, that has been in orbit around Ryugu, and you'll remember has already grabbed some material on a previous touch-and-go mission. It's now successfully this month grabbed an even larger second sample, and probably a more important sample. So it did this on the 11th of July. What it did was it deployed a shiny disc onto the surface as a beacon. This is what we're aiming for. It was a landing marker. And then it approached carefully when getting ready for this grab of soil, surface material. It slowed as much as down to just 4 inches per second. It was that gentle a landing. But the landing site was a very fresh crater, and that was one that it had made itself. Because you might remember in April, I reported that Hayabusa had bombed the asteroid, firing in a projectile to dislodge all of the surface material to expose subsurface material. Material that hadn't been seen, material that hadn't seen the vacuum of space before, because it has always been covered by the highly irradiated surface, irradiated whenever the comet approaches its nearest to the sun position. So that freshly excavated crater was where this second touch-and-go took place. So on contact, when they got down close, the probe, it has a sampling horn below it. So as soon as that touched, it then fired another projectile, a small metal bullet, into the surface to blast up small fragments. And those were then collected by the horn and later sealed into a return capsule. And photographs taken by the probe recorded that all of this worked well and fine, showed all of the debris, showed the collection, and also when it moved away, as soon as it had collected it, it fired its thrusters to come back up to its holding position 20 kilometres away. And the cameras on the probe recorded all of the debris flying around where it had been. So they're so pleased with what they've collected that no further sample collections are needed. There are three containers on board the probe that can be sealed with samples in, but they don't need to risk the craft for a third collection. They've got enough. So that's going to return to parachute down into the outback of Australia in 2020. And as I say, this second collection is pristine material left over from the formation of the solar system, 4.5 billion years ago. So we'll learn an awful lot from studying that. So fingers crossed that gets down okay. Now it's moving further out, in fact, out of our solar system altogether, to exoplanets, other solar systems. You might remember, and listeners might remember, me talking about the Kepler spacecraft that was brilliant at discovering the exoplanets. Well, that has finished its life, but it's been replaced by something called TESS. As you know, scientists have great fun in coming up with names of their spacecraft. So TESS stands for Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Great, isn't it? It personalises it, giving it a name like that, TESS. So that has just now found, again this month it's been reported, three small rocky planets orbiting a dwarf star just 35 light years away. But none of these are in what we call the Goldilocks zone, which is not too hot, not too cold, water would survive and so on. In fact, all three, the conditions for them are described as hellish. But it's the fact that it has identified these three small rocky planets, two of them a little bit bigger than the Earth, but one of them actually smaller than the Earth, only about 80% of the Earth size, so between the Earth and Mars in size. And so, that's a remarkable testament to the ability of TESS, that it's able to detect such a small object. When we first is starting exoplanets, they were massive, super Jupiters they were called, much, much bigger even than our giant planet Jupiter. But now we can detect small rocky planets even smaller than our own world. That's a superb engineering achievement and bodes well for future discoveries. Incidentally, this I talked about hellish conditions. This exoplanet, which rejoices in the name L98-59b, which is just after the name of its, the catalogue name of its star, it is so close to its star that it goes round in 2.25 days, and it receives 22 times the radiation from its star as we do on Earth. So you can see why they say it's hellish. Last couple of items, Dave, in terms of news. Three astronauts safely launched to the International Space Station to bring the crew back up to the level of six. And they did that on the anniversary of Apollo 11, launching, of course, in a Soyuz from Baikonur. So, as you'd expect, there is a Russian commander, Alexander Skvortov, from Roscosmos, a physician and scientist from NASA, Andrew Morgan, and an Italian as the European Space Agency astronaut, Luca Paritano. So they're now up there on the space station, and they will be resupplied or should have been by now, because SpaceX were due to launch yesterday. The mission was to launch a Dragon's resupply vessel was meant to be Wednesday, but storms off the Florida coast caused a delay till Thursday. So maybe that's more ground coffee for the Italian, you never know, for the coffee percolator that a previous Italian took up there. Whilst we're talking about NASA missions, I was really interested to see that they've approved development of something called Dragonfly. Now, you may remember last month, I think it was, Dave, we talked about a little helicopter that was going to be flying on the NASA 2020 Mars mission. Well, this is going to be a quadcopter. And it's not going to be for Mars, but for the big moon at Saturn, Titan. Now, Titan, although it's a satellite, it's actually bigger than the planet Mercury. Now, of course, that's been visited once before by the European Huygens probe, which hitched a ride on the NASA Cassini spacecraft. And a lot of that was led by scientists from the UK, John Czarnecki, for example. Now, this NASA mission to Titan is to launch in 2026 and landing in 2034. But flying on Titan is actually easier than on Earth. Saturn's moon Titan is... A world that looks rocky, but it's actually probably going to be a water world like some of the other moons of Saturn and indeed Jupiter. They believe that there's a water sea, ocean, under the surface. And that surface is thought to be, rocks made of perhaps ice. Cometary ice and so on, but the liquid on the surface is probably mostly methane, and the atmosphere is also methane. So that means that it's going to be a very dense atmosphere. They reckon it's four times denser at the surface than the air in which we exist and breathe. Also, because it's relatively small, the gravity is only 1/7, what we have on Earth. So if we can fly quadcopters here, then we could certainly fly quadcopters all around the surface of Titan. So that development has just been approved. I do like the name Dragonfly as the craft. I've seen artist's impression of what it might look like. But, it looks a little bit like one of those long wings out the side with the copter elements on. Okay, so that's it, Dave, my report on things that have taken my fancy over the last month.
What a fascinating set of things going on at the moment, John. Thank you for the update.
My pleasure.
Stars over Surrey, constellation of the month.
So what is your constellation of the month then, John?
This month it's a constellation quite small, but called Lyra. Named after the musical instrument made by Hermes from a tortoise shell and given to Orpheus, who, of course, was a member of Jason and the Argonauts, and he used that lyre to subdue the voices of the sirens. The home of one of the brightest stars in the sky called Vega, so easily found in the summer months almost overhead, and it's one of the corners of the group of three stars that Patrick Moore called the Summer Triangle, the others being Altair in Aquila and Deneb in the constellation of Cygnus. It's got a couple of nice Messier objects within it, M57, the Ring Nebula, and M56, a globular cluster. So detail about that on the slides and in the video that accompanies the programme.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Now, John, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
Well, August sees the Milky Way almost overhead, running through the constellation Cygnus, very close to our constellation of the month that I've already mentioned, Lyra. As So it rises in the south near the constellation of Sagittarius, sweeping up through Aquila, the eagle, through Cygnus, the swan, and then travels on through Cassiopeia, the mother of Andromeda, and starts to tail off by the time it gets down to Perseus. So it's a good time of year to get out and try and find the Milky Way. Sweep your binoculars along the Milky Way. You'll be amazed at the number of tiny small stars that you see behind all of the bright stars that constitute these constellations that I've mentioned. The new moon is on the 1st, the first quarter is on the 7th, full moon on the 15th, last quarter on the 23rd. But we are starting to get dark skies again now towards the end of the month. The sun rises at the start of the month at 5:30 and sets at 9:10. But by the end of the month, the sun sets about 7:20. So we will be starting to get not just astronomical twilight, which is all we get at the moment, it will be astronomical night as well. Not too many planets to be seen at the moment. Of the four rocky planets, well, three, because we are one of them, only Mercury is visible. And that's a morning object for most of the month, but probably better in the early part of the month. And that's just fairly low, 5 degrees or so above the east-northeast horizon in the morning. Jupiter, though, the first of the gas giants, still prominent in the early night sky. But best for the first 2 or 3 weeks of the month, because this month it's starting to see it losing altitude as our orbits, our position in our relative orbits diverge. So it is deteriorating as the month draws on. Saturn still there as a good evening object in the south. Jupiter is in the south-southwest, and just look a little bit across to the south and then you should see Saturn. It's actually above the main stars of this constellation I've mentioned in terms of finding the Milky Way, Sagittarius. Uranus and Neptune are both to be found. Uranus as a morning object, early morning sky, just after midnight in the south-southeast, and can be found in the constellation Aries by binoculars. Its magnitude is plus 5.7, so in theory a naked eye object, but you'd have to have fantastic vision to be able to find it, particularly in our light-polluted skies. You would see it in the later evening as well, but best a little after midnight. Neptune is a late evening morning object as well, in the constellation of Aquarius in the south. But that one, magnitude of plus 7.9, so that means no chance in binoculars, really. You need a telescope. A few things in terms of phenomena, things happening during August. So on the 1st, a challenge for you. Try and find a very, very thin crescent moon, and it'll only be 0.8% illuminated, but it should just be visible if you look between 15 minutes to 30 minutes after sunset in the west-northwest horizon. And just to remind you, sunset on the 1st is at about 10 to 9, so look shortly after 9:05 through till about 9:30. Hopefully you should be able to find this very, very thin moon if you've got a very low horizon to the west-northwest. You can use the moon to help you find planets if you can't otherwise find your way. On the 9th, the waxing gibbous moon is just quite close to Jupiter. The moon will be 1.5 degrees north of Jupiter, above it. And on the 11th, the moon will have moved a little bit across and then will be sitting not too far from Saturn in the south. The big event of the month, though, is the Perseids meteor shower. Now, that's already running, in theory, but it's the maxima is the time when you generally get out to see the meteors. And the maxima occurs on the morning at 7 o'clock, when, of course, the sun will be up, of the 13th. So the best time, then, is to get out the evening before on the 12th, stay up as late as you can into the early hours of the 13th. You know, just point your chair facing east, which is where Perseus will be rising from. Perseus is the radiant, the point from which the meteors seem to be coming. But that's a very vigorous shower, probably, you know, one of the best showers of the year. And many of the meteors have quite long, persistent trains. You won't need telescopes, just lie back in your lounger or deck chair and look up at about 45 degrees and watch any point of the sky, because the meteors will come from anywhere, or will be seen anywhere, but will seem to have come from just below the eastern horizon. So good luck with that. 17th, you could get out and see Mercury just very close to one of the Messier objects that I sometimes mention. This one is M44, Praesepe, otherwise known as the Beehive Cluster. And that rises 90 minutes before sunrise, and Mercury will be right next to it. Also, we've got this sort of thing happening a few days later. On the 26th and 27th, the planet Jupiter passes in front of a globular cluster in the constellation of Fucus. So it's a telescopic object, because the globular cluster is magnitude plus 8.9. It's not a Messier object, it's got its own classification number, NGC 6235. But it might make quite an interesting sight to see Jupiter passing in front over the 2 days of this globular cluster. Okay, so that's it for phenomena for August, other than to say noctilucent clouds. We mentioned them last month, and it's still time in the first week or so of August, last chance to spot these. So look north up to 3 hours after sunset. Remember, they're not water vapour clouds, but ice crystals about 80 kilometres up. Meetings at local societies. Not many to report, Dave. It's the summer. People have holidays. So Guildford AS, no meeting in August. There is one at Farnham, however, on Tuesday the 13th of August, and the title is Living on Mars by Colin Stewart, who I think is a Farnham AS member. Croydon, their autumn dates are yet to be posted because of their summer break. And Yule Astronomical Society, again, no meetings in autumn. However, one that I don't often mention, because they're not a formal society, but a bunch of amateur astronomers who like getting into the pub, talking about astronomy, and then getting out with their telescopes. And that's Walton Astronomy Group, so the nearest one to this particular radio station here in Weybridge. But they have announced a dark sky trip. And that will be on either Friday the 23rd of August or Saturday the 24th of August. And they say from 8 till late. Okay. The venue and the actual night will be decided nearer to the date. So check their Facebook page or their website. So just Google Walton Astronomy Group, nearer the date, and you'll find when they've decided to go, where they've decided to go. I know they've got one place out on the South Downs, but they're trying to find better, well, as good, nearer places. One that they've tried is just on Ranmore Common, just above Dorking, where Ranmore Common is quite high and the chalk cliffs drop away. So it might be that it's that site that they use. They have used it before, but check the website for details. So astronomy on television for the rest of us. The Sky at Night is on the 11th of August at BBC4, 10 o'clock, repeated on Thursday the 15th, again BBC4 at 7:30. And the topic is European Space Agency mission selection. And their literature about it, their text says, only a handful of missions are sent into space every decade. So how do space agencies decide which are cleared for launch and which are grounded? This month, Sky at Night goes behind the scenes as ESA selects its next F-class mission for launch in 2028. The team meet UK teams vying to have their ideas selected, including a mission to a comet. So that might be the MSSL one that I mentioned last month. MSSL have got an involvement in that ESA project. Another programme to alert you to, it started this very week, and of course that's the well-known local scientist, Professor Jim Al-Khalili, who's from the University of Surrey, but does so much now on television with really interesting science programmes, and of course the his programmes on radio too. So he's got a new series out called Revolutions, which explores the extraordinary story of six remarkable inventions. The first one, this week, was the aeroplane. But two of the remaining episodes are within our interest area. Aircraft are in mine as well. But episode three is called The Rocket. Now, I believe that to be on Tuesday the 6th of August. And then episode 5 will be about the telescope. And so I believe that to be Tuesday the 20th. Unfortunately, the BBC schedule doesn't go that far ahead. So I'm just working it out as to when those ought to be. So these are all on Tuesdays on BBC4 at 9 p.m. But I'm sure, of course, that they will be available on iPlayer, as are most good BBC programmes. So that's it, Dave. That's all my What's Up news for August 2019.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insights.
My pleasure.
Now, this show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items that we couldn't fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday the 30th of August.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemitis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.